the next thing you asked me for is a thumbnail sketch of me as a person and my Scientology career, from which you can select bits of that for use for promotional material. This will be, in effect, a very condensed version of the 4.5 hours of tape which are already extant in the possession of Greg Pickering, which he asked me to record, of the Scientology reminiscences of myself and Anne. So this will be a condensed version of that, with the stress on me. I was born on the 3rd of February 1927 in Tottenham, an inner suburb of London, England, and I was the only child of two working class parents. My early years were in growing up in that semi-slum area of Tottenham were fairly uneventful, but the personality as I developed showed more and more interest in what might be called introspection, more and more interest in things to do with the mind, more and more interest to do with scientific things, and more and more interest in things artistic rather than things to do with the body, such as sport or travel or things like that. In other words, I was growing up to be what's sometimes loosely called an intellectual. At an early age at school, I showed a fair aptitude, a good aptitude for mathematics and scientific subjects, which and of course the English language. I was always very good at the English language. My weakest subjects were foreign languages, simply because I could never see any reason for foreign languages. I just couldn't understand why there was foreign languages. I thought if you had a good language like English, there's no reason why everyone shouldn't speak it. So I was never interested in speaking foreign languages. And so I was never good at foreign languages at school. I'm not a linguist. I'm hopeless at languages. But nevertheless, I do have a good command of my own language. When I got to 11 years of age, my parents moved from the rented premises we were living in Tottenham, and Dad bought a house out in Edgware, which is about 12 miles out in northwest London. And at that time, I passed my scholarships and went off to what was then known as a county school in order to get my matriculation, and eventually it was foreseen that I would go to university and get a degree. That was what was confidently predicted by my parents and my school teachers, because I was always fairly well near the top of the class and showed a good aptitude for maths and science. They agreed that I was good university material, but all this was suddenly thrown into the melting pot when I got to 15 and a half and 16 and developed an enormous desire to play a clarinet and a saxophone in a jazz band. And so I arrived at the age of 17 and a half. I got my matriculation, but I squandered my university chances. And so I arrived at the age of 17 and a half, a better than average jazz clarinetist and saxophonist, but a rather a poor prospect for university training as a scientist. My two great artistic expressions in life have always been music and writing. Later on in my life, I did actually write a 300,000 word novel, which I never sent off for publication, but I did actually write it and enjoyed it immensely. So there are my two artistic expressions, are music and writing. So I left school around about 17 and a half, 18, and got myself a job. And my main interest in life at that time, of course, was playing my music. I was out every night of the week virtually playing in dance bands and so forth. I was earning a lot of money. I was earning more money from the dance bands than I was at my day job. As the day job was getting nowhere fast, this didn't bother me. All my interest was in music, and my only other interest was I was an avid reader of science fiction, and also I had, even as a young man, an adolescent, a considerable interest in psychological matters. So by the time I got to 18 or 19, I'd read all I could lay my hands on of Sigmund Freud and Jung and Adler, I was well versed in psychoanalysis, psychotherapy, and so forth. Everything that was known on the subject, if it was in the local library on the subject, I'd read it for sure. It was my hobby. Was the mind. So that gives you a thumbnail sketch of me around about the age of 18 when I left school. Well, I went on like this until 1950 when I was 23. So the period from 1945, 46, 4 or 5 years there was devoted in almost entirely to playing in dance bands. I became a very accomplished saxophonist. I used to do a lot of very good class work. I couldn't become a professional because my hearing was never quite good enough. You have to have very, very good hearing to become a professional musician. My hearing was never good enough for professional. I was accomplished enough on my instruments to be a professional. But the best I could achieve was top-flight semi-professional, which I was. I was a top-flight semi-professional jazz musician by the time I was 20, 21. And that was in the period 1945 to 1950. In 1950, I read the article in Astounding Science Fiction. Of course, I was a science fiction fan, and that changed my life. I had at that time I had a subscription to the American Astounding Science Fiction magazine, and an email subscription. So when the first articles came out in May 1950, I think it was in the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, a week after it was published, the magazine arrived, dropped through my letterbox. I was right on the ball reading Ron Hubbard's first article in Dianetics in the science fiction magazine, the Astounding Science Fiction magazine, and I immediately got in touch with a bookseller to get the book Dianetics air freighted over to me from America. And due to various delays and so forth, none of which were to do with me, all to do with the bookseller and the publishers and so forth, I didn't actually get the book until early August in 1950, when the book arrived. One Saturday I was phoned up by the bookseller and he told me the book had arrived, and I got on my motorbike and I was over there that Saturday and got the book, and spent the whole weekend reading it. And that started me. That was the start of my science, Dianetics and Scientology career. Was August 1950. I was mightily impressed with the book by Ron Hubbard. I was mightily impressed with the whole thing, and I ended up going round trying to get my friends, my old school friends mainly, to try and find a co-auditor. Well, that meant lending the book out to them, and it all delayed time, but eventually an old school friend of mine agreed, and he read the book and thought it was okay. He was nowhere near as enthusiastic as me, but anyway, we got down to doing some co-auditing in September. It had been about first or second week in September that we actually started our co-auditing, and I found out later that that I was the second, he would be too, because we were co-auditing, that we were the second people to start auditing in the whole of the UK. We were preceded by George Wishlow in Cricklewood. He was, I met George and later, and he put his first pre-clearance session in the middle of August 1950. And he did years afterwards, he did some research on this, and he couldn't find anyone in the whole of England or anywhere in the UK that had audited prior to August 1950. He reckoned he was the first, and I don't know of anyone who audited prior to that. So I'd say that Georgie Wishlow was the first, and my co-auditor and I, we were the second ones to start actually using Dianetics in the whole of England. By the end of August, by the end of September and October, of course, there was a lot of auditing going on over in London. By the end of the year, there was dozens and dozens of, lots and lots of people were auditing by then. But those were the beginnings. I wrote off to the New Jersey Elizabeth Foundation that Ron had set up, and they gave me the address of the Northwest London Group, which was run by George Wishlow, and I dropped down there and joined the group. And quickly I was, as George was a very good he was a very good group organizer and a very good auditor, George was, but he wasn't all that good technically, and he quickly realized that I was, you know, even in those early days I was showing a flair for the technical side of it, and he used to field the questions of the group over to me. And eventually I became the group, well, within weeks I became the group secretary of the Wishlow group. I was one of those very fortunate people that, that I had a good auditor. He was, well, he was an old school friend of mine, you know, he was a well-educated young man, and he could follow instructions as given in the book, and he audited exactly as per Ron said, and he happened to be blessed with a very easy running pre-clear, that was me, and I got incredible results from that material of Dianetics. From that first book material, incredible results I got. I started off with a black field. I had no pictures. I had no sonic. I, you know, very poor impressions. And within a few sessions, my Vizio turned on. I had beautiful Technicolor Vizio, but then sonic impressions, and then sonic on the track turned on, and accurate. All the perceptive channels were within 6 months of auditing, all the perceptive channels were running beautifully, were running fine, exactly as Ron said in the book. And it wasn't until I audited my own free clear, my co-auditor, when I audited him, he was a much tougher case than I was, and although he made good gains, and he was very happy with the gains he made, they weren't as spectacular as the gains that I was making and that I made under his auditing. We continued the co-auditing team for about a year, and then suddenly one day he upped and said he was going to get married. He'd been meeting this girl, and he decided to get engaged, and it was going to be a quick wedding. He was going to get married. Well, Sigmund Freud once said that when the patient announces that he's going to get married, that is a success of the therapy. And in his case, it was. It was a success of the therapy, because most of his difficulties that he had in life were sexual. And when we started therapy, started auditing, he was far too shy to even approach a girl, let alone ask her to marry him. So I'd done a hell of a lot for him, and he knew it. And he thanked me very much, and he went off and got married, and they've lived happily ever after, as far as I know. So he did get an awful lot out of it. But I never thought he got as much out of it as I did. Maybe I'm wrong, maybe he got as much out of it as I did. Anyway, we broke up our co-auditing team, and I had to go and find another co-auditor, which I did, from the group. By this time in London, there was various groups. There was a Central London group. There was a group out in East London with Stanley Richards, who was running that group. I met Stanley, but I'd written to him, phoned him. And there was in the Southwest London group, it was run, the Battersea group, was run by a lady called Anne Walker. And again, I'd written to her and phoned her up. And then in late 1951, I think it was, a guy called Jack Horner turned up and ran a congress in London. And we all got all these people that we'd known each other over the telephone, we all got met each other, you know, and I met Anne, and we fell in love, and got married, and met Stanley Richards and so forth, and it was a very, very marvellous congress that was in late 1951. At this time I was still carrying on my dead-end job in the daytime, spending a couple of evenings a week auditing, and Sunday evenings, of course, were group member night, group night. And then one evening a week, I was as group secretary, I was devoting to my typing letters and keeping up with the group's correspondence. And the rest of the nights of the week, I was out around the dance halls and the palais doing my, earning some money and enjoying myself playing my dance music. So it was I was a very busy boy during that period, from 1950 right the way to 1951. Very, very busy I was indeed. And it never let up at all. I was flat out the whole time. I was either auditing, being audited, doing something for the group, or I was out playing a saxophone with 1,000 dancers dancing around in a dance hall, and getting home about 1 o'clock in the morning and dropping into bed and getting up at 7 o'clock, going off to my day job and so on. And this would just go on day after day after day. When I'd learnt to play my own musical instruments, I'd sensibly taken some lessons from one of the best jazz saxophonists in London, one of the best jazz saxophonists in Britain actually, and he taught me to read accurately and phrase very accurately. And I was making, well, during this period from 48 to around 51, there was a hell of a shortage of good class musicians in London still because of the after effects of the war and so forth. And the promoters quickly realised that here was a young man who could read and phrase spot perfectly in a dance band, and I was in enormous demand there. And I was out every spare time. I was turning jobs down every spare moment I had. I mean, I could have done more work than I was doing. I could have been out every night I wanted to, leading five-piece sax teams in dance halls. It was incredible, you know. It was hard work, but it paid very well, and I enjoyed every moment of it. Anyway, after that, it was a mad whirl. He soon announced that he was going to give an HBA course in London in September. No, when was it? September, November 1950. It ran about 8 weeks, it did. And it started very soon after he visited the Wishlow Group. And I had to make a decision. What do I do? Do I become a professional Scientologist, or do I continue on with my band work and the life I've been leading? Well, I just thought, well, I'll take the plunge. I'm not getting anywhere with my day job, and I can never be a professional musician. So I might as well take a plunge. So I put my money down and did the first HPA course in London in September 1950. No, it was in September 1952, and did the HPA course that Ron taught in London in 1952. The end of that course, we all got an HPA certificate. Ron had said, if you send in three case histories, he said, there's a Hubbard graduate auditor certificate waiting for you, for any of you that send me in three case histories using the material I've been teaching you on the course. And I thought, well, that's fair enough. So within a couple of weeks, 2 or 3 weeks, I'd grabbed myself I had the pre-clears and audited them and sent in the case histories. And lo and behold, I got myself an HGA certificate. Now, quite interesting historically, that is probably the rarest certificate in Scientology. I found out later there was only 4 of those certificates ever issued from the 15 people that were on that HPA course that Ron gave in 1950. Only 4 of us sent in the 3 case histories and got the HGA certificate, and mine was numbered number 1. So it's quite a unique one. Numbered 1, and there was only 4 of them that were ever issued. They were never issued for any other course. Ron resurrected the HGA certificate years later as a graduation certificate on the St Hill briefing course, but he'd used it much earlier in 1950. That was its first use of the HGA. So I ended up at the end of the course, within a week or two of the end of the course, with an HPA certificate and an HGA certificate. I was feeling very, very proud about that. Meantime, Anne, she couldn't be on the course. She couldn't afford it, truthfully, and but Ron had, she'd been in touch with Ron, and he hired her to look after the Hazzy. He set up a Hazzy in London right at the end of the course, and Anne was the secretary, and she virtually was the association secretary. Anne was the first association secretary of Hazzy London, and I used to come in and about 6 o'clock in the evening to take her home. And then one evening Ron dropped in, bounced into the room. I was waiting, she was typing a letter, and we were going to go off and have a meal and go home to get the children fixed up. And Ron said, looked at me, he said, I want you as director of processing for the organisation. So there I was London's first director of processing. The job mainly consisted of looking after auditing the HBA students, because they'd set up an academy, and a guy called Dennis O'Connell was running it, doing the training, using Ron's tapes, and Ron wanted those students to get some decent auditing, so he selected me to do it, and he said, we're going to set up a clinic, he said, but that's going to be a little bit in the future when we get some money, he said, going to afford some premises for the clinic. So I was the first DFP of London, as in London.
Of course, there wasn't enough students on course to keep me employed full-time auditing students. So the referrals obviously used to come in to HASI for an auditor, and they used to get passed over to me. It's a natural thing to be passed over to me as the director of processing. So until such time we had a clinic, I was doing the any referrals came in to HASI for an auditor, they would be passed over to me as the director of processing of the organisation. So that was what I was doing, spending my time doing. And doing the auditing, I was full-time, flat-out auditing as a HASI staff member, as director of processing. Now, this takes us on through 1953. And the next thing of great moment was in 1954, when Jack Horner reappeared. He'd reappeared back in 1951 and gave a congress, and now he appeared back again in 1954. Ron had been giving some clinical courses in the USA, some doctorate courses, and Horner was one of the star graduates, and he was good. Horner was good. He knew his stuff. And Ron had sent him over to England to run a clinical course over in London. So the first London ACC was held in 1954. First and second were held in London by Horner, and I was on that, and so was Anne. We were both on that, and we graduated from that and got our doctorates when we completed all the course requirements and so forth. And so that took us through to 1954. And by this time I've got quite an imposing array of certificates on hand. I've got my HPA certificate, I've got my HGA certificate, and I've got a Bachelor of Scientology certificate, and I've also got my Doctorate of Scientology certificate. So I had quite an imposing array of certificates on hand. I was probably one of the most certificated auditors in London. I don't know of any that had four. Many had three, but four was unusual. It was the HGA that made it unusual. Because I did actually collect the HGA certificate back in 1952, which the others hadn't bothered to collect. For a period then, Anne and I were out of the organisation. There was a palace revolution, and there were some changes made, and we went out of the organisation. And then back in 1955, Ron wanted us back in the organisation, so Anne came in this time as registrar in the clinic, and she also came in as DFP, director of processing, in the clinic. And that's the time you would have remembered her, in 1955, when she was raised in DFP in the clinic in Palace Gardens Terrace. At that time, I'd moved off the auditing line. Anne had taken over that DFP hat, and I was now DFT. I was in charge of the training in 1955. And I was also in charge of examinations worldwide. And Ron was very concerned at that time about the
about the bad state of examinations all over the world, and he wanted it cleared up. And I was spending a lot of my time drawing up examination papers for various grades of auditing and passing them over to the old man for approval. I was the examiner worldwide and also DOT worldwide. A lot of the administration work from the other orgs was coming through London because Ron was in London at the time. And so he may be DOT worldwide while he was in London. So I was a very busy boy during that period. I appreciated the change over from the processing to the training side because it broadened my experience of Scientology considerably. Up to then I'd only had a very, very broad experience of auditing and DFPing, and now I was adding training and DFTing to my skills. I was broadening out my tech skills considerably, and also examining. I was also broadening out my skills on the subject of examinations and technical requirements and so forth. I was becoming quite an all-round technician by 1955 in the field of Scientology. Anyway, towards the end of 55, there were some more changes made in the org. There's always changes being made in the org, and I think I should mention that, point it out at this juncture, because over the years many people have said that Ron Hubbard was a very poor player in his organisation. Well, this was simply not true. In the years that when Anne and I worked for Ron in London, we earned very good money working for Ron in the organisation. Ron was not a poor payer. He was a very good payer. He was paying top wages to a staff auditor that came in straight off the course and come in just as do a week staff auditing. He was such a person could earn the same amount of money as they could as a skilled engineer, say, in a factory. So he was paying a top flight week's wages to a staff auditor, and us executives, we were earning way above that. So it's not true to say that Ron Hubbard was a poor payer. What gave the impression that Ron Hubbard was a poor payer was when he went on to the unit system. This happened prior to the unit system. The unit system didn't come into about 1956, 56, 57. And then, of course, it was a different story. But while Ron was paying salaries, he was a good payer. And he certainly was not a miserly payer. So I'd like to squash that rumour, squash that for sure, that he was not a poor payer. He was a very generous payer of salaries, Ron Hubbard. Anyway, there came some changes, and the end point was that Anne and I left the organisation in late 1955 and decided to emigrate to Australia. And we actually left for Australia in 1957. During 1956, we were both field auditing from Battersea. We retained the flat in Battersea, and we were both auditing there from the flat. And in 1957, I'd been in touch with Ron. And, Jack Parkhouse was the association secretary at this time in London, and I'd got Jack's agreement to do some HPA training in Sydney, Australia. In other words, I've got the rights to train, and I've got that in writing. And so we left for Australia in May 1957. And Anne never did work for the orgs anymore. She never worked for the org in Australia. And when she left the org in 1955 in England, that was the last time she ever worked for Ron. So we got to Australia and met a guy called Marcus Tooley, and who was a very good administrator, but who had a very, very poor tech, and he needed someone like me. And he had a whole host of students, and I needed some students to train as HPAs. So we closed terminal with Marcus and I. He provided the students and I provided the training. So I spent the first 6 months or so running a weekend course training, giving the first HPA training in Sydney. This was in late 1957.
And then when I come to graduate my students, I got them all trained, I'd examined them and everything. All they needed was a seal of approval to get their certificates. I mean, I had all the rights there to train them and examine them. It was all in writing from Jack Parkhouse. But I mean, I had been examiner worldwide. I mean, I was dreaming up the goddamn examination papers. I was completely qualified to examine my own students. And then when I wrote over to London, Jack Parkhouse had moved out. There's been some changes, more changes in Hazy London. And there was new people in there, and there was new policies. And they said, sorry, Dennis, we can't certificate your students. They'll have to go down to Melbourne and do the HPA course. They'll have to do their HPA training in Melbourne. There's an org would be set up in Melbourne by this time. Well, of course, I was furious. Because this was a betrayal of my trust. I was now stuck with 20 students who I'd promised an HPA certificate to, HPA training. And but nevertheless, their policies were inflexible. And so I wasn't very much I could do about it except apologize to the students. They took it very nicely. They were a good crowd. And I went then to see if I could get some more students and do some more training, but without the rights to train, there wasn't much I could give them. There was a lot I could give them, but I couldn't certificate them. I couldn't validate the material I was giving them. And there was an awful lot of unpleasantness went on at that time. It was a very, very silly policies. Very, very silly policies going into place at that time on the subject of training worldwide. And the end point was I went back into practice again. Went back into auditing practice again. And meantime, I've been continuing to go auditing all the way along the line. And went back into practice and also resurrected my music, my love for music again, and got back into the jazz scene in Sydney and joined the music scene in Sydney and began to make my name as a musician in Sydney. So my life filled up again with music and auditing. Then in 1960, late 1960, they opened up Peter Williams, who was running the org down in Melbourne, came up to Sydney and decided to open up a Hazy in Sydney. And I strolled in there one day and felt an urge to get back into harness again and rejoin staff. And George Allen, who was the association secretary, he couldn't believe his good fortune that he'd landed such a well-known, well and capable Scientologist in his organisation. He quickly put me in charge of the academy and the training. And I did the training in Sydney, was DFT in Sydney, all right the way through 1960, 1961, and right the way through to, in 1962. In 1962, Ron started the briefing course by then, and wanted me on the briefing course. So I went over to the UK and did the briefing course. Then George did the briefing course, George Allen, and while he was away, he put me in charge of Hazy Sydney. In fact, I was holding the association secretary hat and the HCO secretary hat for Sydney. That broadened out my administrative experience. I learned how to run an org. George was away for nearly a year. I was not only running the org as association secretary for a year, but I was also running the HCO sec post as well. There were two senior exec hats I was running for the org. Anyway, eventually George came back, and I went back. He came back and picked up his association sec hat again. We got somebody else in to do the HCO post, and I went back into the academy. Went back to my old hat, doing the training, and the org in Sydney at this period went through a rather lean time financially, and for a spell I had to leave the organisation. The pay just dropped below survival level, and I had to get out in order to live. But I went back again and picked up my old hat again in 1964. Picked up my old training hats again. Then they brought in the new organisation board, and they needed someone in qualification. So they decided that they were also going to run a foundation an evening and weekend. So they said, well, they got Peter Sparshot was going to do. He was a recent graduate from the briefing course, and he was going to take over day qual. And so I took over the evening and weekend qual for the foundation. And that was the last job I did for the for HASI, for the organisation. By this time, the ethics policies had come in, and were getting heavier and heavier and heavier. And the conditions were getting worse and worse and worse there on staff. And eventually, we simply parted company. I could no longer work under those circumstances, and so I quit, and so that was the end of the end of the association I had with the organisation. But behind the quitting was the heavy ethics. I simply couldn't. I agreed wholeheartedly with Jack Horner. Jack Horner. Somebody once asked Jack Horner what he thought of HASI, Scientology organisations. He said, "I love their tech." He said, "But I'm scared to hell. Their ethics scare me to hell." And I felt exactly the same way. I love the tech, but my God, those heavy ethics scare me to hell too. And I didn't like them one little bit. Anyway, the end point was that, that in 1966, I think it was 65, 66, around about that summer, yes, it was in the summer period that I quit, very early in 66. I parted company from the org for the last time in HASI Sydney, and I never worked for the org again. I then went back into private practice when I could get some pre-clears, and when I couldn't get pre-clears, I got myself a day job. But most of my interest was in my music. I was back on the heavily into the music scene. I was out many evenings a week playing jazz on my clarinet, and I became quite a well-known jazz clarinetist in Sydney during that period. And then the urge to write came upon me. And I wrote a 300,000-word novel. That took me a couple of years. I enjoyed every moment of it. I never did get it published. I wasn't interested in getting it published. I wanted to just write it for the sheer joy of writing it. I had a lot of fun with that. And so I am quite an accomplished writer. Quite accomplished. There's nothing like writing a 300,000-word novel to make you into a good writer, I can assure you, as you would know yourself as a professional, that there's only one way to become a good writer, and that is to write. It would be around about this time, 1966, 1967, 68, that the ethics in HASI got heavier and heavier, and everyone was getting... All the old-timers in Sydney and the old-time Scientologists in Sydney were getting declared sort of suppressives, and sooner or later Anne and I got declared too. I've forgotten the grounds upon which we got declared, you know. I think we were breathing too regularly. I think that was the trouble. We were breathing. It was something silly like that. And we both got declared, and that didn't mean anything to us. And life just sort of jogged on. Yes, well, life just jogged on. And I suppose the next most important thing that Anne was continuing her auditing practice. She's continued her auditing practice all down the years, quite continuously, quite regardless of what I was doing. She's just continued to her auditing practice. And then the next thing of note is that I got this urge to seriously began to get down to the idea of a do-it-yourself psychotherapy. And I realised that if the planet was ever going to get cleared, it could only be get cleared on a do-it-yourself basis. That was the only way it was ever going to happen. In the final instance, I set myself the monumental task of figuring out how to do it. And well, as they say, the rest you know. I did crack the problem, and the answer is in your hands. It's Tron, and that is really the culmination of my professional career. Is that is in that work there, and it does exactly what it's supposed to do, and I'm very, very proud of it. And if people use Tron, and if they get half the case gains out of Tron that I got out of Tron, then my professional life won't have been wasted. My all the work I put in to doing that research, and it won't have been wasted. And I'll be a very, very happy person if they can get just half the cash gains I got out of it. So there we are, Terry. That brings us into present time. So I hope this material is of value to you. Right, this is the end of the personal thumbnail sketch of the life of and professional life of Dennis Stevens.